one, if it is dangerous, and how come nothing ever happens to any of them? Dick?
Is Alexander Fleming invent the Fleming valve?
Yeah, there's more than one Fleming. But, you got a point, Ed. However, that's called anecdotal evidence. You got to be careful with that one. In the case of anecdotal evidence, I can choose a relative, you can choose a relative, who smoked 2.5 packs a day, and they did it for 40 years, and they survived. That doesn't mean that 2.5 packs a day is safe. So that's anecdotal. You got to be a little bit careful with that one. However, take a large enough survey of a big enough chunk of population that is now statistically significant. Find out what's the rate at which they get lung cancer and what's the rate at which they're smoking cigarettes. That's essentially what C. Everett Koop did, our attorney general, our surgeon general, way back in the 70s. And boy, he had an uphill battle for a long period of time. But eventually the world started listening to him. And we've come to the conclusion that even secondary cigarette smoke is a darn dangerous thing. And it's a peculiar habit that the cigarette itself is a drug delivery system. And part of the drug it's delivering is carbon monoxide, because that's the agent that probably has the greatest amount of reaction on the human being that the smoker thinks he desires. So we got to be careful that we don't get too anecdotal on this one. But any information that we give, even if it's not the absolute best, we're going to try to put our best foot forward and give radio a fair shake. Because when it comes to saving human life, you're going to be very hard-pressed to find any one single piece of modern-day technology that does more to save life. So when it comes to risk-benefit ratio, and there's risk in everything, you climb into that automobile, which kills 40,000 Americans per year, it's a dangerous thing. We've come to accept it. It's been around a long time. It gives us a huge benefit. We take defensive driving courses to make sure that we're not going to be victimized by it. We set up better, safer roads with safety pads around the place and whatever. However, we still are a little bit blinded. Let me drop. Many Europeans will visit the United States and say, how in the world do you tolerate a utility pole every 150 feet up and down almost every one of your streets? Don't you know how ugly that is? Don't you know how many people die because their vehicle strikes that very solid thing? To a degree, they're right. And some of that is tradition and acceptance. Some of it is economics. Some of it is also reliability. You can decide you're going to, in your community, bury all of that wiring underground. Your community will look a lot prettier. That's the good news. It's 3 times more expensive, and it's a little bit lower in reliability because of all the varmints down there that love chewing through a cable, and all of the wire, all of the water and everything else that wants to attack it. So there are pluses and minuses everywhere here. But as I see it, the pluses on radio are 98%, and the minuses are 1 or 2%, and most of that is perception, human perception, because of those emotional words. WS2N, I know you've been waiting patiently, and there's probably others. K2RAW, go ahead, Paul.
Okay, you were talking about the 1 million to 1 ratio for the cell phone to the year and the tower. You have to consider that some people are always saying that the tower is on, that transmitting 24 hours a day, maybe, to some degree. The person with the cell phone might only be using it a half hour a day. So you're better at breaking the math down. You're going to have to give that argument for the listeners that think of these things. What does that million to one change to? You take the half hour and the 24 hours, you make that 48, you've got to divide the million by 48 or... you're going to have to come up with a new number, Dick, because of that, the time factor. I know it's so astronomical, it's not even close to being a problem, but they'll want to know that number, Dick. WS tonight.
Carl, you don't know any teenagers.
Yeah, he said half hour, and Ed believes that real teenagers self-respecting teenagers today where they're text messaging and talking to their friends. They're probably on the phone close to the 3 hours. But let's take his half-hour example. A half-hour out of 24 hours is a 40-to-1 ratio, roughly. If I take a million-to-1 ratio of real RF energy that gets that your body becomes exposed to, a million times more energy with that cell phone against your head versus living directly next door to that base station, and I divide it by 40, I've now still got a 25,000-to-1 ratio. There's still, even with the time difference of a light user of a cell phone, half hour a day, versus living next door 24/7 with a cell phone base station blasting all the time, if you want to use their vocabulary, it is still 25,000 times more energy for that light user, total amount of energy in the head. But even that argument is pessimistic compared to reality, Paul, because RF energy is not accumulative. If you and I do the mathematics of a 24-hour day, we assume it accumulates. The 60 years of research by all the major countries on planet Earth have revealed that as long as you're below a very high threshold, as long as you're using the recommended exposure levels, if I am exposing myself to a milliwatt per square centimeter today, and I expose myself to a milliwatt per square centimeter tomorrow, and I add today to tomorrow, my total exposure is 1 milliwatt per square centimeter. It does not accumulate. By comparison, nuclear radiation, which we are not, if I give you 1 millirentgen today and 1 millirentgen tomorrow, it's a little bit less than 2 millirentgen of total exposure. A little bit less because the body does a little bit of repair in between those two exposures. But nuclear radiation, ionizing radiation, does accumulate. RF energy does not accumulate. There's a slight exception to that rule. When you take the huge concentrator that exists inside of your microwave oven, where you're putting 700 watts of power into approximately 1 cubic foot, and it's a highly repeater.
Time out.
It's a highly reflective cavity where the RF energy in that microwave oven bounces back and forth till some portion of the food finally absorbs it. That's the way the microwave oven works when you properly close the door. That's a real concentrator of an amount of exposure to your food that's way beyond the minimum permitted exposure for a human being. In that case, it does accumulate. If I cook my egg, if I cook my hamburger in that oven, in that microwave oven, for 1 minute now, and half an hour later I cook it for another minute, I've got close to 2 minutes worth of cooking, because it's way beyond the minimum permitted exposure. In that case, the heating is up to the level where cooking takes place, where a chemical change takes place in the food, and yes, there it accumulates. But when you're below the threshold of minimum permitted exposure of RF energy, it does not accumulate. So even if they try to add up 24 hours a day versus a half hour of use, that argument breaks down. Unfortunately, what I just told you is not easy to convey. You say that to your next door neighbor who is not technically oriented, and he'll accuse you of using technical mumbo jumbo. The best we can do is keep exposing them to the stuff. It will eventually sink in. The way human nature works, if you get enough information exposed to, if you're exposed to enough information for enough sources for a long enough period of time, and assuming you're lucky enough to expose yourself to valid information as opposed to invalid information, finally it starts to stick. That's an opinion. I know you guys have got some more opinions as to what we can do in this runaway situation. Another onslaught is on the way, is the way I see it. Another runaway condition is going to happen. I'd like to believe this one is going to be a shorter one and a little bit more friendly, because we do have some past history to back us up. This is not a brand new situation. And obvious by the fact that American National Standards Institute, the division of the IEEE, which starts off, that is the organization, that's the organization that's given the responsibility for setting the standards for what the American public is exposed to, and those standards in turn go to the Department of Defense. Your Air Force, Army, Navy, and whatever is using that ANSI document. The American National Standard Institute C95 document is the defining document for this nation. There's a similar document, very similar, in the United Kingdom and each of the major countries of the world. There's a very similar document based on their research and their assessment of our research. So we're not alone in this one. All the major high-tech countries in the world have done this research over the last 60 years. We're not just coming up with some new radical opinion when we said radiation, RF radiation, and here I am using that ton word, RF exposure, RF signaling, RF transmission. The standards that we're using are as close as you can get to bedrock of what the community of informed people on planet Earth have studied and discovered in 60 years. You can't turn your back on that. Without going to live with the Amish and the Mennonite, you can't turn your back on that. If you're going to live in modern society, you have to accept automobiles, you have to accept penicillin, you have to, and the modern day equivalents of it, you have to accept radio and wireless technology and what it does to defend our life today. K2LIW listening. Anybody else?
2EO, Dick.
I heard both EO and Mel. Rich first. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, just taking it in the opposite direction for a minute, I'm going to make lemonade out of the lemons, at least for myself. And you don't have to give me an answer right now. You may want to get back to me next week. If I wanted to say to the cell phone industry, I'm a ham radio operator, come put up a tower in my backyard, pay the X number of dollars rent, I will give you a back room to put equipment in. By the way, pay me rent and put me up a free element theme. Who would I contact?
I can probably answer that question for you privately. And even if I can't, there are a number of other amateurs who have been in that exact situation and had a favorable outcome. So if you've got a good location in White Plains where there is a dead spot for cell phones, and you've got a building that's tall enough, a piece of land that's tall enough, that's desirable for a cell site base station, obviously one should be put there because a lot of life and limb is going to be saved in your community. A intelligent person in the year 2009, living three doors away from a brand new established cell site, should not look at that and say, oh, that is homely, I don't want to have that unsightliness on my horizon. A irrational person, an uninformed person can easily say that. A more rational, informed person will say, look at that beautiful piece of hardware. I can count the number of lives in the next 5 years it is going to save. I am glad it is there. Virtually, you're doing the same thing when you drive down the street and realize that every 150 feet, you have a utility pole. If you want to be rational about that one, you can say, thank goodness those utility poles are there. I have 120 volts, two circuits of it in my house. I can turn on any appliance I want to. I can turn on my wired phone back in the days when I used to use it. I can turn to my internet connection for the people who are using wired internet connection, or even the fiber optic type. I can say, I am very glad those utility poles are there. They are giving a lot of benefit to society. We're not objective enough to recognize that, but that's the truth. We don't even see their homeliness. We experience their benefit. We get a warm, fuzzy feeling when we finally think about it. Those utility poles do a lot of good things. They do a lot of bad things. I can count the tens and hundreds of people on Long Island that die per year because their automobile strikes the utility pole. We have come to accept that risk-benefit ratio because we're not willing to pay the 3-to-1 price increase to make all of that wiring underground. That's the reality of life in the 21st century in these communities. So that cell site base station is not ugly if you know how to look at it. It is a lifesaver. That's a strongly felt opinion. And so, yes, there have been amateurs. Particularly, I know of one in Connecticut, I know of one in Massachusetts, I know of one in Virginia, where they had a big enough piece of property, they had approval for the antenna they got, and they went to a cell site and said, a cell company, and said, please install a system here. I'll give you cut rate, but I'd like to have the cash flow. I'd like to have good cell phone coverage. I know it's not going to create any interference to my ham radio equipment because you only radiate a few watts. I welcome your existence. You've got a dead spot in my town. I'm in the middle of that dead spot. Let's get together. There are amateurs who have done that. However, let me drop. You talk to the cell site people who are doing the installations, and they come up with various numbers like a quarter of a million or half a million dollars per cell site. That's the money they have to set aside just to fight the political opinions in that town to convince the residents that the installation is safe. That's not the price of the hardware. That's the price of the lawsuit. That's the price of the attorneys, the price of the experts confirming in each one of those towns over and over again the exact same case that is safe. The FCC, by way of the Communication Act of 1996, saying that you cannot deny the siting of a cell site based on biohazard. They tried to help that situation. The cell sites still have to, the cell companies still have to set aside a great big chunk of money because of the perception of risk and because of the perception of homeliness, because people don't know how to look at it. In 1948, when my family put a television aerial on the top of the chimney of my house on Yoakum Avenue in Farmingdale for television reception, we and my neighbors looked at that aerial and said, look at that beautiful thing. What a fantastic piece of technology. I can now watch Howdy Doody. I can now watch Ernie Kovacs. I can now watch a little bit later Ed Sullivan. I can get all of this great moving picture electronically in my house because of that beautiful thing on the chimney. You come along to the year 2000, and there are a significant number of communities saying, I do not want to see a television aerial on the chimney of the house in this community. You can put it inside the roof if you want to. You can hire a cable company, but you're not allowed to have a television aerial in many communities in the year 2009 or 2000, so to speak, because people think a television aerial is ugly. You only think it's ugly if it's a brand new thing and you're objecting to it. People do not look up in the air. Do the experiment. Of all the people who visit you, ask them what is the color of the shingles on your house. And 9 times out of 10, they cannot give an answer because they don't look up in the air. And if there was a television aerial on your chimney alongside of the color of the shingles that they don't see, they would never see that unless someone tells them, hey, you should be alarmed about this. Craziness. KE2EJ. Here we go. K2K.
Repeater. Timeout.
K2KUI. Go ahead, Mel.
One more comment, Dick.
Let me go to Mel first, and then I'll come back to you. Go ahead, Mel.
Dick.
Let me go to Mel first, and then I'll come back to you, Rich. Go ahead, Mel.
This is K2KUI. Dick, you talk about uphill battle. I'm just thinking of two different instances that are apropos in another way. One particular person passed away about a little over a year ago, and he carried a cell phone and everything. I mean, very up-to-date, very intelligent person, but refused a certain kind of a treatment that no doubt possibly, very possibly, could have saved his life because of certain kinds of religious biases. Now, some of these religious biases, you know, go date back to the Middle Ages, and people are still strongly believing in those things. So you expect in one generation or less to change people's thinking on cell phones. Well, I could tell you a group of people I'd like to see you convince them how successful that a certain medical treatment is in certain diseases. And let me see if they will make a decision to take the treatment or they will die. And he died because he refused to even take the treatment, which would have given him possibly many more years to live. Another case, I know in this day and age, people that refuse to have their children inoculated. And in fact, one case we know, family friends, they moved out of the country because you can't get a child into school here without being inoculated. So tell me, how do you convince people, if they have that trend of, you know, their mind is in that mindset, that you're going to convince them that a cell tower is safe, sick? You can't convince them that inoculations are safe or a proven medical treatment is safe. And this is life, really directly life and death. But you see how people are, and you tell me that we're going to try to work on these people and convince them otherwise with cell towers. I think you got a battle on your hand, Dick. Over.
I have to wonder if these people have ever seen the joy of whooping cough.
Good point, Ed. Good point, Mel. What you told me, Mel, accurately, is it's going to be tough. And President Kennedy in 1961 says we're going to go to the moon and do other things, not because it is easy, but because it is hard. And the unstated statement is, not only is it easy, we're not doing it because it's easy, but we're doing it because it's hard, and the benefit is worth the price. We were fighting one hell of a Cold War at the time. Our pride was on the line. Yuri Gagarin had already been the first man in space. He wasn't an American. A man in space, a woman in space, a dog in space, all before Americans got into space. Our pride was hurting. We thought we had high technology. We had to do something about it. Kennedy made a declaration, and when Armstrong stepped onto the moon in September of, was it June, but in 1969, our pride really came back in a hurry. So it's going to be difficult. We have to do it because it's the right thing to do. And I'm with you. I have a close relative that a couple of years ago died because their particular religious faith said that you don't use the artificial things to correct a cancer condition. You pray for the cancer to go away. Unfortunately, the prayer wasn't answered. The person died. And you can't deny in the 21st century the modern chunks of technology, whether it be medical, electronic, whatever, that defend our lives, that make improvement. Nothing is perfect, without a doubt. Yes, a small percentage of the population, when you give them a vaccine, are going to have an adverse reaction. If one person per 100,000 has an adverse reaction, but 10,000 people per 100,000 survive a particular pandemic, is that worth the investment? It's obvious. Cost to benefit ratio. It's hard for non-mathematical, it's hard for non-mathematical people or non-scientific people to accept the fact that there's a risk in everything we do, and risk only has meaning when you compare it to the other risks and you compare it to the benefits. Getting out of bed in the morning is dangerous. Climbing in your automobile is dangerous. Drinking a glass of water is dangerous. People die from all of those things. But if you're smart enough to know what the risks are, you educate yourself as to what are the risks, you minimize the risk as much as possible, and then you proceed with the action, because you have no choice. When it comes to living in general, you're not going to get out of this one alive. We're all on the path to eventually dying. The best we can do is make the journey pleasant for us and our friends and the people we care about, try to make some change in it all, leave some offspring with some ethics, and try to educate ourselves enough as to what the risks are and how to avoid them. You're at a tremendous risk if you deny the benefit of wireless technology and radio. You can't do that in the 21st century in the major metro area. If you want to go to some very rural portion of the United States or some very rural portion of the world, you can live without wireless if you think it's that important to you. But don't force it on your neighbors. Their survival depends on it. That's the way I see it. Ed, I think you probably want to make another comment on all this, and then I'm going to turn it over to Rich. Ed, you're a pretty smart guy. What should we do to swing the public opinion on this? WB2EAV, K2LIW?
Unfortunately, I think you got the conclusive answer. First, am I making it? I changed my antenna.
You are beautiful. Stay there.
I am not moving a muscle. If you have people who are willing to risk the joys of whooping cough because they think inoculations are bad, it's an uphill battle, and all you can do is try to do the right thing, because you'll never ever convince everybody.
Yeah, you're right. We have to accept the fact that two steps forward, one step back. It's going to be a battle. No matter what you want to do, if it's worth doing, usually it's not easy. Most things that you want to do these days, the things that are left to do, are not easy. All the easy things have already been done. This is a very tough battle. It's not going to be won tomorrow or the next month or the next year. It's going to go on. This is a multi-generational subjective opinion, a prejudice, an erroneous prejudice that has gotten started right the day of Hiroshima is what really kicked it off. Because all of a sudden, planet Earth discovered nuclear radiation, and that emotional word radiation got linked together with RF radiation. And here we are fighting this battle over something that's as safe as a 30-watt light bulb, and I'm not kidding. N2EO, I bet you the people in Whitestone are not quite that prejudiced. I'd like to believe. K2LIW, go ahead, Rich.
Hey, Dick. N2EO. Well, my next-door neighbor, who's got two small children, did question politely the vertical that's in the yard. I explained to him the difference between ionizing and non-ionizing radiation. And he seemed to understand. Whether he pretended he understands or understands, I don't know. But I haven't had any more problems. Talking about prejudices, and then I'll get back to what I mentioned before, I think Miller's right. It's going to take a long time. If you go back, I don't know what made me think of it, but the name James Meredith in 1960, a black man, it took 25,000 troops to get him into a college in Mississippi or was it Alabama, one of those two states, and it took 50 years before these people were accepted. So I think it could take 50 years, Dick. Getting back to the other situation, you keep saying White Plains. I'm in Whitestone, Queens. You may want to give me an email. The only drawback, it's a very small piece of property. But without going into too much detail, my mother died 11 years ago. My father is in the hospital and not well. It would solve two problems for me, income and antenna.
Sorry about that. That slip I keep doing over again. I keep calling you White Plains, and it's Whitestone is the community you live in. And Mel has made it clear it's going to be a tough battle. Ed is accepting the fact it's going to be a tough battle. When it comes to the prejudices in the United States and the James Meredith study, extremely tough battle. But every journey begins with the first step. We got to start somewhere. We can't just say, hey, this is too tough, we're going to walk away from it. We are the radio mavens. We are the people who use it, love it, understand it. It gives us a warm, fuzzy feeling. We've been living with it. Psychologically speaking, we've been in bed with it for a long period of time, and it's a darn good marriage, a very good relationship, if you know what I mean. It's very difficult for us to point to any one of our radio enthusiast friends who have been injured by it. The risk-benefit ratio, the risk appears to be extremely small. The benefit appears to be extremely high. My raison d'etre, my reason for existence, is to be an electronic engineer, and 90-some-odd% of everything I know about radio and electronics and wireless came from ham radio. I went to a darn good college, and I took a number of graduate courses beyond that. And they gave me a lot of foundation. They gave me a sheepskin that allows me to call myself engineer. But that's not where the knowledge is coming from. the working knowledge day to day did not come from that point. And some of the smartest engineers I know, and I can point to a couple of them, don't have a college degree, and one of the really smart ones doesn't even have a high school degree. That alone is a strong, significant piece of credential, but it's not an absolute prerequisite to doing good work in any field. But in my particular case, and I'm not alone, let me drop. I know of no other hobby that can possibly be more educational. It combines the best in modern day technology, and if you don't think so, just look back at what happened in 1971. From my point of view, the cell phone concept, one of the biggest inventors was a man named Reed Fisher, W2CQH, Whiskey 2 Quebec Hotel, Henry, wait a minute, CQ, Charlie Quebec Hotel. He was showing me what he was doing at Bell Laboratories in 1971 on cell phone development. The phone patches that we amateurs were doing with handheld 2-meter radios, that was the birth of cell phones. We were there. Motorola got the credit for inventing the cell phone because the first operational base station happened to be done by Motorola in the Chicago area. But that's not where the concept came from. So we amateurs did this, among other things. I'm just giving examples of how extremely educational and beneficial this hobby is. Once you establish that communication by setting up an antenna, a transmitter, a receiver, and a feed line, talking to people about it, now you're talking to people who are using a similar one and comparing the best of the best. You talk to somebody who tells you about an antenna that works better than the one you got. And then you talk to another guy who talks about a transmitter that's better than the one you got. It's an automatic feedback perfection process going on here, and education all the way. And in my case, set an occupation, and it set a lifestyle. And it gave me an attitude of, I've got a certain amount of control of the undeterminable things that Mother Nature does to us. Not everything is ever going to be known, but this is a path of getting a lot of that knowledge and sharing it with people and perfecting it. You'll be hard-pressed to find a more educational, more beneficial hobby than ham radio. And the wireless technology itself, to say, and again for the 40th time tonight, it is saving a hell of a lot of lives. You can't turn your back on that. You can't turn back the clock. We can't go back to a 1900 lifestyle. It won't fly in
repeater. Time out.
So no matter how sincere that community of 7,000 human beings is, they must be educated, they must be corrected. The longest journey begins with the first step. We've got to start doing it. It's going to take years. I hope I'm wrong. They are firmly entrenched. There are a couple of very charismatic individuals in that town who have developed an extremely strong opinion. They have convinced other people to join this particular crusade. It is an erroneous crusade based on a fallacy, but it has been extremely well propagated, and it has become a minor kind of a firestorm in that town, in my opinion. A tremendous amount of money and anguish is being wasted, and lives are being put at risk. It's got to be corrected. We got to take the first step of this long journey and make improvements. We have the ethics to drive us to do that. We have the knowledge. We shouldn't keep that information we have under a bushel basket. You can't keep that light under a bushel basket. We've got to share it with them. That's an opinion. Give me some more opinions. K2RIW on the TechNet.
KC2MDP.
Go ahead, Steve. How are we going to get out from under all this one?
Like you said, it's going to take time. It's going to take a lot of time. My question is, that story you were telling us earlier, and I think you told it to us a couple of weeks ago, and I meant to ask you when I first heard it. That thing, I think it was in France or something, where the people were getting the headaches and stuff, and they found out that the cell site wasn't even operational. Was there a conclusion to that? You know, did they say, you know, what happened after that? You know, they explain anything, why the people were getting headaches and stuff? Obviously, it wasn't from the cell site. Back to you.
The article strongly implies, it doesn't say it, that it was psychosomatic. You can convince yourself that you're getting a headache. You can convince yourself you're getting a nosebleed. You can convince yourself you're getting a metallic taste in the mouth, because you've convinced yourself you're being exposed to a very dangerous kind of RF radiation from that 20,000 or 50,000 pound piece of hardware just outside of the window of your apartment building that was installed last month. And you can convince the law authorities in Versailles and Lyon, France, that a lot of the community is troubled by this, and so you can convince a judge and jury to decide in your favor, and therefore order it removed. And the people doing the removal then reveal the fact that, hey, this is crazy, it wasn't even operational. You and I would like to believe that now the judge would go back and reverse his decision. No way in hell. I hope I'm wrong, but I don't think they're going to reverse it. I mean, you and I have seen enough 60 Minutes programs and frontline programs and other kinds of things like that where, say, for instance, a whole town in Texas made a whole bunch of decisions that were crazy, and you got DNA evidence later on showing that these guys were innocent, they weren't even there, and you got lots of proof finally when it's brought to bear that this person couldn't possibly have committed that crime. He wasn't in the town, he wasn't in the state, and the DNA doesn't match. And you bring that to the authorities and hope that they're going to release that guy immediately from prison. They say no. That was done by a jury, judge and jury. This is a fair case. We convicted him. He's going to stay in jail. So do lawsuits suddenly get reversed? And do decisions get suddenly reversed because you got brand new evidence? The answer is eventually yes. Is it going to happen immediately? No. The article ends with the fact that the lawsuit went in the wrong direction, but the cell site was ordered to be removed, and it is being removed at the time of the article being written. And as I said, this article is in the October issue of IEEE Microwave Magazine, and it's in the latest issue of Antennas and Propagation. That's as authoritative as you and I can get, as far as I'm concerned. The article is real. The decision as bad.
Repeater, time out.
The decisions, as bad as they were made, and I'm convinced what I know about the way law is usually conducted and the way human nature exists, these are not going to be reversed anytime soon. Those were psychosomatic illnesses that those people had, and now you try to convince them, they're going to simply say, well, the hardware is there, it's attracting signals, therefore my malady is real, even though the antennas weren't yet installed and it wasn't made operational. That hardware was attracting the signals from other cell sites nearby. I'm speculating now. They didn't say that yet. But I guarantee that in the mind of these people who had these illnesses, so to speak, they're going to come up with any excuse in the world because they knew they were right. They won their lawsuit. You can see why I think that this problem is not going to go away in any reasonable time soon. This new onslaught is going to last for some ridiculous length of time. This is the next wave of craziness in this area. I hope I'm wrong, but that's the way I see it, Steve. KC2MDP, K2RIW.
Yeah, very good, Dick. Yeah, I have an unfortunate feeling that you're right. It sounds like, you know, the same people who still believe we never put a man on the moon for various reasons. You know, they give you any excuse, and so long as it's dead set in their mind, well, their belief is gospel, and your belief, well, you know what you can do with it. Back to you, Dick.
It's a toughie. It's prejudice, pure and simple. This happens to be a technical prejudice as opposed to a racial prejudice, but they've got the same flavor. It took a ridiculous number of generations of re-education to partially reverse the racial prejudice that existed in this country. It's going to take some length of time to reverse this technical prejudice that we're going through right now. And some of us are going to suffer the consequences. Some of us are going to be forced to take down antennas. I hope it doesn't come to that. Some of the new antenna installations that are coming before zoning boards are going to have a tougher time because of this situation going on in France. And France ordinarily is a progressive country. A high percentage of their electrical power is nuclear. They are running 59 nuclear power stations in that country successfully. Part of their success is due to the fact that early in the game, they chose one single nuclear power station design, which was known to be reliable, and they just duplicated it 59 times in a row. We in the United States keep continuously changing the design of the nuclear power station. Each time we build a new one, we say, well, we want to put in the latest technology. We've discovered this, we've discovered that since. Let's add these new zigzag, these new doodads to it. Many of our nuclear power stations are all different, and therefore finding the commonality between their strengths and weaknesses is difficult. And that's part of how we ran into the problem of Browns Ferry, Alabama, Three Mile Island, and they ran into the problem of Chernobyl. Different designs in all those cases, with weaknesses in the education of the people running them, weaknesses in the design itself, that allowed the accident to occur. So here we are dependent on oil because we're not using as much nuclear as we should, and we are spilling American blood to defend that source of oil. That's very expensive in dollars and in human loss of life. And how many people have been damaged by nuclear power stations in the United States is a difficult one to evaluate. But it's nowhere near the number of people who...
Repeater, time out.
It is nowhere near the number of people who are dying defending our right to receive oil from those particular hot spots in the world. We're paying a heavy price. I wish we had a lot more energy independence. To have to import 20 million barrels of oil per day to support our lifestyle is a ridiculous vulnerability. I wish wasn't there. And we're paying a heavy price because of it. We have the technology to set up solar, wind, tide, geothermal, all of these renewable energy resources, biofuels and so on. We have the technology to do it. If we make the investment to become energy independent, we'll be a hell of a lot better off. We'll be a hell of a lot less dependent on the stability of a bunch of not-so-stable nations around the world that happen to be oil-rich nations, and we need their supply. And we have to kiss their ring to make sure we keep getting that supply. I wish we didn't have that. There is a better way. We have the technique to do it. That's another whole area that, you see, I got some pretty strong feelings on. Well, enough bad news for one night. Mel, hopefully you've got a little bit better news of guys doing a nice, simple search for a better antenna in your email, and I know it's awful late. I think you ought to open at least one or two of them. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY, yeah. We could debate this indefinitely and go absolutely nowhere because I'll make the final words on it. We've proven, like you say, smoking is detrimental to our health. In the meantime, the consumption of tobacco has risen tremendously. And you see a new generation coming up now, and I see them smoking. So it shows you that with all that that's been going on, how many years now with smoking, it's still a problem. Anyhow, okay, no, I'm just looking over right now. But, okay, here's one, quickie. This person writes, he says, I'm a little confused that I want to put up a straight dipole antenna, and I see that in the handbook they show it being set in one case with 72 ohm twin lead, another case 72 ohm coaxial case cable, and the third case ladder line. Which one do you think is the better way to feed a dipole? Go ahead, Dick.
I know that Mel is a pretty strong advocate of ladder line for good reason. And that is, although the frequency where the dipole is a half wavelength, any of those feed lines will work like a charm. But once you feed a dipole with ladder line, which is so forgiving of mismatches as long as you've got the right antenna tuner, you now can use that one single antenna on other bands. Now, a dipole is not that expensive. Almost all of us have the ability to pay the price and do the installation where a dipole for 20 meters, a dipole for 10 meters, a dipole for 40, and a dipole for 80 can be erected on your property. Now you get the highest possible performance out of dipoles. But if you decide you're lazy, you want the mostest for the leastest, and you feed it with open wire line, you can feed that dipole on almost every one of those frequencies and get moderately good performance. Ladder line is a hell of a lot more forgiving. N2EO, N2MB, a number of those guys made that hard discovery, which I was reluctant to accept at first. So with an antenna tuner, you get more bandwidth, more frequencies out of a single dipole. But as Mel and I have also been saying, there's nothing magic about feeding the dipole with that particular transmission line and feeding it at the center and setting the dipole exactly parallel to the ground the way it's shown in the books. A pure vertical dipole, fed at the center if you like, fed at the bottom if you listen to me, can give you a lot more performance for the bang, for the dollar. You don't have to put down the ground plane radials. You get a lower angle of radiation to the horizon. So the word dipole sounds simple, old-fashioned. There's a lot to be discovered on that simple antenna that's been around since 1867 when Heinrich Hertz invented it. So all of those will work. And we have the resources to take whatever you've got right now, install it, and then do the experiment a month from now of trying the other transmission line and comparing the results and coming back and telling Mel and Dick what you found out. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. I don't think you're really ever going to see any real difference. As you said, of course, it's just a matter of your choice. But will you ever see any drastic difference if, say, it's a short run? I could see long runs that no doubt the ladder line is going to give you somewhat maybe better performance. But if you have a short average run, say of, let's say 50 feet, which the average amateur radio operator will usually find is sufficient from his dipole that distance to a shack or whatever, do you think you're really ever going to see anything appreciably different between 72 ohm twin lead, you know, or 72 ohm coax cable, or even say ladder line? I would say most likely there's literally no difference. I think it's just what is your preference and how you want to connect it to the tuner, Dick. Over.
You're absolutely right, Mel, when it comes to the fundamental use of the dipole. What N2MB and N2EO discovered is that you take an 80-meter dipole, feed it with any feed line you want, and feed it at 80 meters. They will all work like a charm, with a couple of tenths of a dB of difference. You can't even see the width of the needle of the S-meter that'll make the difference in signal strength loss, depending on which one of those feed lines you use, on the fundamental. But if you're now a little bit too lazy to put up a 40-meter dipole, and you take that 80-meter dipole and feed it on 40 meters to a south pole, when you feed coax cable with that high a standing wave ratio, which is like, what, 30 to 1 or something like that, it's huge. Whereas you feed it with a line, not only is the magnitude of the standing wave ratio a whole lot lower, but the feed line itself is a whole lot lower in loss when it's being highly mismatched. So they came out a whole lot of decibels ahead of the game when they took an 80-meter dipole and fed it with open wire on 40 meters. Now, if the guy never intends to use the 80-meter dipole on 40 meters, every one of those feed lines will work like a charm. But if you're not willing to put up another 40-meter antenna to back up your 80-meter antenna, And if you want to use the 80 meter Regeneron 40, then that open wire line into a good antenna tuner can give you quite a number of dB of more performance, is what they discovered now. And now that I found the right formula on that subject, I confirmed it as far as what the prediction is. Use the right formula, which is a bit rare, but it's in the antenna handbook, the ARL antenna handbook. But the total loss of a transmission line when you know how high the VISWR is, you'd be amazed how much that can climb. K2KUI, K2LIW.
No doubt. Of course, I've talked about this a number of times, especially to a station on 75 meters that wound up putting up quite a bit of property, and he was able to install a nice full-wave loop. And in fact, it was a multi-wave, and it wasn't just one-wave loop, it was a multi-wave loop. And when I told him originally to use the open wire feeders because of the reasons of what the most likely the residual resistance you will find in a loop antenna, somebody struck me down, said to him, no, you don't know what he's talking about. You'll use good quality coax and you'll really see something. Well, he went through all the work and a lot of expense of buying hundreds of feet of coaxial cable just to find out that I was right in telling him that the original way that I proposed to feed it with open wire feeders was the ideal way for him to go, especially the amount of distance that he was traveling from the feed point to his shack. But it's, like I say, you look at this open wire feeders, and they look like, how could that really work well in this day and age when this beautiful coax cable, you know, is so well made? And Dick, this is part of the problem, even exists in ham radio. There are very closed minds. Go ahead.
Yeah, but one of the places where we really shine is antenna experimentation. Almost none of us build our 80 through 10 meter single sideband transmitter receiver. Almost none of us nowadays. You can buy it with 1 or 2 weeks salary. It would take you a year and a half to build it. You buy the commercial product, choose a good one with 1.5 weeks salary, and if you don't like it a year from now, you can get 80% of your money back. It's a respected design. It's got a proven track record. It's got favorable history. The one that you homebrew, I don't care how good it is, you'll have a devil of a job selling it if you decide you don't want it anymore. It's going to be a big effort to build it in the first place. So we don't build our transmitters and receivers. For the most part, we don't build our transmission line. We can build antennas. And no matter how many antennas you've got in your backyard, if you are sufficiently curious, if you're enough of a tinkerer, you're always going to build more antennas. In order to make things not cluttered and neat, you may take down some of the old ones as you put up the new ones, but if you're smart, you're going to start putting up the new ones along with the old ones and comparing the results. And it's an automatic perfection process. And you get on the air and say, hey, is my signal louder with this one? Let me flip over to the other one. So we're going to be building antennas. And as such, they're inexpensive for the most part. The wire and the insulators and the easy launcher, the slingshot that sends the weight up into the tree so you stand on the ground and haul up a string which hauls up a rope which hauls up your antenna. There's all kinds of things that you've got in your yard that can act as supports for antennas, and there's never enough of them. And don't worry about putting another piece of wire in the air. 98% of the people never see the wire. They don't look up. They look at the sidewalk they're walking on to make sure they don't get tripped. They don't even see the color of the shingles on your house. So we can get away with murder when it puts up all kinds of wiry antennas on our property. And if you listen to Mel, you'll find ways of putting up wire that are even invisible to your fellow ham radio operators. He's got that green piece of vertical wire in that evergreen tree out in front of his house. And if you're not told where to look, you can't even see it. And it's one of the highest performance antennas he's got. K2KUI, K2LIW.
K6DBZ with comment.
Go ahead, Hal.
The commercial goes through. I just mentioned another approach is using a folded dipole, which will give you a little more bandwidth on a specific band. Also, when you're feeding it with 300 ohms of ladder line, you have even less loss because of the IR loss and the impedance going to the antenna. That's my only comment, K6DPZ.
Good information. Yeah, folded dipole is another very nice antenna built out of inexpensive materials. Hal, have you been told that you're over-deviating?
Talking too loud.
Okay, your gain is set very high. You're going into speech clipping either on your rig or on the limiting that takes place in this repeater, but you're really potent. It sounds about 60 dB loud, is my opinion. And the next time you and Andy, well, I was going to say you and Andy CDL, you've got the test equipment. You just have to turn it on, Hal. Back to you, Bill. K2KEY, K2LAW.
Hey, very good. Well, just going to put some final words in. Only one exception you say about building rigs. A number of people I know now, have tackled that Elecraft K2 radio, that transceiver that is sold as a kit. It's put together in a reasonable amount of time, and believe it or not, the demand for them, even after they're constructed, is very high. So a number of people, again, have questioned me about, homebrewing, if it is viable, some of these kits. And I can tell you that Elecraft has, besides the K2, they have a couple of kits. They do work quite well, and they are able, these people, summon them with not a lot of experience in the kit building field, have yet been able to do a very good job in a very reasonable time. So don't let us get discouraged with that. Gee, you reminded me, I got a lot of emails on kit building, especially of this Elecraft that is advertised in a number of the magazines, Dick, over.
Beautiful. Glad you brought that to my attention. We got about 10 seconds left. We're going to be cut off. You listened to TechNet number 1,263. 73, you all. Bye-bye. Back to you, Mel.
Yeah, we'll put some aside for next week. I do make an effort to help some people directly. So we're not really neglecting those that are really, some of them really in need. I try to steer them in the right path. 73s, everybody. Again, those who celebrate the Jewish New Year, Happy New Year to you and your family, and thank you all for joining us. This is K2KEY, a very good night to all.